Om Namah Shivaya. Dear listeners of Shaivam.org, the next program is Spiritual Discourse. In this, you are about to listen Kawai Hindu Lectures. The titles are Harmony Relationships, Monism Theism, presented by Sri Shivaya Bodhinatha Velayatha Swami.
Good morning. This is from the recent Living with Shiva lesson. Conflicts with other people. Good interpersonal relationships help the meditator a great deal, and meditation helps keep those relations harmonious. When we get along nicely with others, meditation becomes easy. If we have problems with other people, if we argue or disagree mentally and verbally, we must work exceedingly diligently in order to regain the subtlety of meditation. Poor interpersonal relationships are one of the biggest barriers, for they antagonize awareness, causing it to flow through the instinctive and intellectual forces. This puts stress and strain on the nerve system and closes inner doors to superconsciousness. We talked about this idea a few weeks ago in terms of, I think the phrase I used was, yoga is controlling awareness throughout the day. Something like that was the phrase I used. And the idea is that, as Gurudeva points out, what we do during the day impacts our ability to meditate. They're not independent. One isn't the work we're doing during the day and the other is meditation, and they have no relationship. It's the same awareness. So if we antagonize awareness, we get our nervous system upset through having trouble getting along with other people, it impacts our meditation. That's what Gurudev is saying. We need to realize that the two are related. So therefore, when we're really serious about meditation, we need to keep our interpersonal relationships throughout the day harmonious. If we cannot get along with our fellow man, whom we watch closely, observing the expressions on his face and the inflections of his voice, how will we ever get along with the forces of the subconscious, which we cannot see, whether we find superconscious areas of the inner mind when we face them in meditation? Obviously, we must conquer and harmonize all our relationships. So this is an interesting point. When you think about it, what's Gurudeva going to say? How do we conquer our relationships with other people and make them harmonious? Well, the easiest way, of course, is to change the other person, because we're perfect, right? Obviously, if that person can't get along with us, then that person should change. No, Gurudeva doesn't say that. He says, we must conquer and harmonize all our relationships, not by working to change the other person, but by working with that other person within ourselves. By working with that other person within ourselves. For we are only seeing in him what is in us. He becomes a mirror. We cannot allow the unraveling of the relationship by attempted outer manipulation, discussion, or analysis to become a barrier to deeper meditation. Instead, we must internalize everything that needs change, work within ourselves, and leave other people out of it. This helps to smooth interpersonal relationships, and as these relationships improve, so does our ability to meditate. So Gurudev is saying, if we have trouble getting along with someone else, there's something in us we don't understand. It's we see in that other person. Otherwise, we could get along with them. But if we can't get along, it means there's part of ourselves we're not seeing and understanding that we think is in them. And we react to it. And the more we react to it, the more it's hidden in us. If we really have a big reaction, it means we've really hidden that quality in ourselves very, very well. And therefore, we don't see it at all in ourselves. We totally see it in the other person. And likewise, the less the emotional reaction, the less hidden the quality is in us, the easier it is to find. It's a very interesting mystical way of adjusting relationships. Saves a lot of time, too. You don't have to sit down and have long discussions with someone. Try and change them. Try and figure out how you can get along better by changing things, because it's all inside of you. So it's much faster to work with. It doesn't mean that every quality we see in someone else we need to think is a great quality. It's not saying that. It's not saying we feel that some things really shouldn't be there. It's saying we can understand it. We can accept it. It's when we can't understand it or accept it or work with it harmoniously that there's a problem. In other words, it's in us and we're not able to find it there. There's a related point. Benefit of interacting with others. It's a quote I copied down. I don't know, probably popped up on Taco one day, and I have a little file for quotes of Gurudeva that struck me at the time. This is called Benefit of Interacting with Others. So it doesn't come from the previous material. It's separate. They fail to realize or accept that interaction with others, whether householders or monastics, is needed to bring up quickly the karmas to be resolved in this birth and perhaps the next, and that avoidance of others offers no stimulus for progress. Oh, again, that's not the common way of looking at it. When there's some challenge when working with another person, we don't usually thank them. Thank you for helping me work through this karma. Usually we're upset with them, we blame them, say, oh, they need to change. But Gurudeva's point is, it's through interacting with others that karmas come up, and if we can understand and resolve them, then they go away. It takes a very great soul to work through karma sitting in a cave by yourself. It can be done, but most people can't do it. It takes the interaction with other people to bring up the karma. So again, it's contrary in that the standard idea is, well, everything should be harmonious with someone else. And if it's not, then that's a problem. But this is saying things will come up and they should be worked through. The last one is, nothing is wrong. In the final analysis, we are all doing exactly as we want, as we must, doing what is next on our personal path of evolution. Nothing is wrong. Nothing should be that is not. Well, this is particularly useful for someone who's responsible for someone else, such as parents with children. Children may not be behaving and or be exactly as you would love them to be, but that's who they are, and we need to accept it. That's where they are on their personal path of evolution. And everyone is where they are. They're not where you want them to be or where they want themselves to be. They are where they are, and we have to do the next thing. And then the next thing. And then the next thing, whatever that is. Well, again, that's contrary to common thinking, which is trying to make things other than what they are. It should be this way instead of that way. You should be this way and not that way, rather than accepting the way someone is and helping them move forward from that point. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful faith. Good morning, everyone. Nice to be back. We had a fruitful time in the Caribbean. I'm sure you know all about it from Taka. I can't tell you anything you don't know. Used to be I could come back from my travels and that was good for an hour talk. I could tell everyone what I did, but now I come back and you've read it all on Taka. So sometimes I'm surprised, you know, I attend an event in Mauritius and then I go to Malaysia and they tell me how many people were at the event in Mauritius that I attended because they read it on Taka. They know more about the event than I did, even though I was there. Well, interesting synchronicity, going to the Caribbean. The Caribbean is, Hindus in the Caribbean are very fond of the Ramayana, and so fond of it. It's customary to greet each other by saying, instead of saying namaskar, they say Sitaram. It's that common. So you hear it on the radio all day long, Sitaram, Sitaram, Jai Ram. Oh, it's interesting that Hinduism today has Sita Sings the Blues coming out right now. So two things, bringing the Ramayana to the forefront of the mind. Right before we left, we had a good meeting with the two Chinmaya teachers from Houston. We didn't know it at the time when we started meeting with them, but they're the two teachers known as Acharyas, who wrote the new version of their children's course. So they're very familiar with teaching children, and we learned a lot by talking to them, and they're in the process of publishing it right now and are generously giving us one copy of the course to review, to give us ideas for our own course, because we're in the started the process of creating a syllabus for age 5 through 13 for studying Saiva Siddhanta. So we're working out a syllabus for that. It's three age groups, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. And each, there's 108 topics, or 36 topics a year. And there's three groups of them, one for each age group. So we have 108 topics at three levels. That's a better way of explaining it, that we're developing. I was talking to them, and you know, we are fairly familiar with the Chinmaya mission, what they do. The teachers said it quite nicely. I suggested they could attend the Hindu Mandir Executive Conference in Houston and to share, you know, some of their teaching efforts is what I thought would be useful. Still think it would be useful, because they're the largest, they have the most number of students. They have something like 25,000 students in the U.S. studying their material, more than they have in India, I was told. That's hard to believe. That's what they said. That's what Swami Ishvarananda said. So they describe their efforts. We teach Vedanta. You know, that's, they keep it so simple. We teach Vedanta. What do you do? We teach Vedanta. So they don't try and go to Hindu activities because of that concept. They don't want to get involved in temple ceremonies and temples and so forth. They just keep it very simple. They teach Vedanta primarily to Hindus, but they teach Vedanta to anyone. They don't make a big deal if you're a Hindu or not a Hindu in their activities. So being familiar with that, I was explaining what we were doing. I mean, our philosophy versus theirs. They were interested. Oh, I explained, and it's in the lessons for today and yesterday. That's why it's our topic. I explained, well, we have a philosophy that's monistic theism. We do two things, not just one, which is unusual. Theism, we focus strongly on the temple and puja, homa, and then monism, we focus on meditation, in particular Raja Yoga kind of meditation, which is the same as the shun. And then I explained our schedule. The monks in the morning, first we come to the temple at 5:30 for our puja, that's our theism. And we go and we meditate for an hour, that's our monism. We have two approaches, which is unusual. Most organizations only have one. They only have one, they only have monism. They're following the Adi Shankara tradition, so they don't use Raja Yoga. For meditation, they use Dhyana Yoga, which is based more on scripture. But their goal is the same. And I think I mentioned to them, we saw the Chinmaya mission in Trinidad, and the two things kind of blended together in my mind. I think I mentioned it to both. Because it really, when I give talks at Chinmaya Mission, which is, you know, every couple of years I give a talk at one of their missions, and the reason is they don't have swamis at all of their missions, just at some of them. They only have a few swamis in the U.S. and Canada, and, you know, maybe only 20% of their missions have resident swamis. So therefore they invite other swamis who they trust to say the right thing. And because of that, I did some very simple research. They have a website and they have quotes of Swami Chinmayananda that change. It rotates through 10 quotes. You just sit there and it'll rotate through 10 quotes or so. And what struck me was so many of them could be something Gurudeva said. They're just they have the same style, a very practical style, a monistic emphasis. The quote I use in one of my talks on happiness is, Chinmayananda said, "Don't put the key to your happiness in someone else's pocket." Isn't that good? I like that. That just captures the whole essence of that talk, which is we depend on other people to make us happy. We're putting the key to our happiness in someone else's pocket. If they treat us a certain way, we'll be happy. If they treat us another way, we're going to be unhappy. We've given away the control of our happiness to someone else. We've put the key to it in someone else's pocket. So you can see how that quote fits right in with Gurudeva's philosophy, right? Oh, there's many quotes like that. That's the one I remember at the moment. So I had an interesting experience once. We went to the Orlando Kumbhabhishekam. So it's a Venkateshwara temple. For some reason, over a period of 3 years, I went to about 4 Venkateshwara temple Kumbhabhishekams. You know, something, who knows why. And so I worked out some talks. There was 3 talks I was to give, and I didn't really distinguish between them. One was at the Kumbhabhishekam, and that one went well. I basically did something Gurudeva would do. Muttaya Stapati was there, so I praised the Stapati and I praised the Silpis and got the whole group to applaud the Silpis and so forth. And that one went well. And then I gave another talk in an auditorium which was adjacent on some aspect of Karma Yoga, and that one went well. But my third talk was on the 3 worlds in the temple, which I thought, well, it's a great topic, right, for Kumbhabhishekam. Let's talk about the 3 worlds in the temple. But I gave it at the adjacent Chinmaya mission. And, you know, the topic didn't compute, you know, because they're monists. The concept of 3 worlds is a perspective that isn't something they think about. They're monists. They're focusing on the identity of the soul with God. There's no three worlds involved. There's no beings in the three worlds. So I learned my lesson there. I said, okay, you can't talk three worlds just because it's a Kumbhabhishekam. You have to figure out where you are. So my subsequent talks at Chinmaya Missions never talk about the three worlds, I can assure you. Talk about monism and hospitality and simple things like that. So the point is, there are two distinct perspectives, and someone who's strong in one doesn't necessarily understand the other. For example, Vaishnava groups. Lots of Vaishnava groups are very strong in the theism, to the point of being dualists. God is over there and I'm over here. Some are qualified non-dualists. But it's very, you talk to the three worlds to them and they'll say, oh yes, yes, you know, that's their cup of tea, so to speak. Talk about monism, the identity of the soul with God, and they'll, you know, that one won't work. So Gurudeva's teachings are unique, is the point, unique as far as I know, in giving strong emphasis to both and explaining two distinct perspectives, one perspective for each. In the Shum language, the monism is Shumif and the theism is Dimfi. And sometimes that sounds confusing. But said another way, the theism or Dimfi is looking from here, you know, looking from the third eye. When you look from the third eye, if you see God, it's as a person. You see the personal form of God. That was Gurudeva's vision of Shiva on Sanmarga. He was looking from here and he saw God in the soul body. Or, you know, you can see Aditi, Ganesha, Muruga in the soul body. You're looking from here. You're using the Dimfi perspective. You and what you're seeing are not the same thing. I am seeing God. Gurudeva was seeing Lord Shiva sitting on the Swayambhulingam. Theism, there was a separation there. As Gurudeva was looking from there. But if you look up there and into the seventh dimension, then you don't see anybody else. You can't see a soul body. You've gone beyond the realm of soul body. As Gurudeva says beautifully, what you experience and what the deity experiences are the same at that point. You're experiencing, striving for Satchit Ananda and Parashiva, what Gurudeva calls the essence of the soul. So that's the monism, the essence of the soul, which can be perceived through the Sarasvara chakra and above, is the same as God, is monism. There's no distinction. It just has to be claimed in meditation. It has to be discovered, so to speak. It's an already existing condition. It's just that we haven't discovered it. Like having something buried in your backyard that's valuable. You're digging over here, you're digging over there, you're digging over there, you're digging over there. One day you find it. And it was always there, right? You just didn't look in the right place. So that's the idea. The identity, the non-dual union with God is always there. We're just not looking in the right place. Why can't we look in the right place? Well, it's like trying to look at the sun on a cloudy day for some people. There's something in between. That's called the subconscious mind. Oh, we have to purify the mind. And then even then, there's something there, and that's called uncontrolled thought. We have to quiet the thought. So we have to get the conscious and the subconscious transparent. Then we experience the superconscious. So it's always there. It's just there's something blocking the vision, or we're not looking in the right place. If there's nothing blocking the vision, maybe we're looking out from here, we're a theist. But we can't find our identity with God if we're looking out from here. There isn't any. Well, the other aspect of the monistic theism is the theism prepares you for the monism, or Charya Kriya Yogayana. The Kriya prepares you for the yoga. Interesting discussion with the Chinmaya Mission Swami Ishwarananda. I was making sure I understood what they were teaching, and so I said, "You're teaching Jnana Yoga, right?" And he said, "Yes, that's what we're teaching. They teach Adi Shankara's Vedanta philosophy, and they teach the practice of Jnana Yoga." Very clear. Most of their centers have a Shiva Lingam, which gets worship, and some of them have a Krishna. Because they're smart, you know, they don't care if they're worshiping Krishna or Shiva. I was talking, and then the Swami introduced me to the resident teacher. Their teachers, when they go through the training program, 2-year training program, which we wrote about in Hinduism Today, remember that? After that, they're called Acharya. So they've had excellent training, 2 years in residence. 2 years living in a Gurukulam. It's a lot of training. Well, the teacher, he was deferring to the teacher, and the teacher said, "We're running into a new trend or a new issue." Don't want to call it a problem, right? That's up my own philosophy. Calling something a problem. It's an issue or a trend. That they're working with 20-year-olds, you know, graduates from universities, and they find them argumentative. They're lacking certain qualities that are really needed to be successful in the Jnana Yoga. That same issue came up with a dance teacher. I forget how the subject came up, but she said her students can do all the emotions except two. What are they called? Rasas in dance? All the emotions except two. Humility and devotion. These are the students in the West, not students in India. They don't know how to express humility and devotion. Same problem the Chinmaya Mission was facing in trying to teach Jnana Yoga to university graduates. They haven't grown up in a strong Hindu community where devotion and humility are kind of built in. Acquiring those qualities is just built into the tight family structure and the festivals and this and that. You have to develop it to some extent because of the society in which you grow up. You won't perfect it necessarily, and you can go to university and lose some of it, but at least you have some. I mean, you could dance it. You could dance it half-heartedly, but you could dance it, you know. But these students didn't have a clue how to express it. So they're missing the theism, said another way. That's the beauty of theism, of tending the temple, of practicing Kriya before we practice yoga. Then we have the right, we have a devotional attitude, and the intellect and the ego are in good shape, shall we say. Gurudeva uses the phrase, soften the ego through Kriya. When the ego is softened and the heart melted, then you're ready to practice yoga. Something like that is the phrase, right? So those are the two qualities that a purely intellectual education or university can sometimes strengthen, is over-reliance on the intellect, a debating mentality, trying to win all the time, Everything's a debate. You're trying to win with your intellect. And a certain sense of pride. I'm smarter than you are. So we have to get rid of all of that if we've acquired it. And soften the ego and be a humble person and a devotional person. And then we're not stuck in the intellect. As Gurudeva says, the intellect is the greatest barrier to the superconscious, right? Usually, when you're studying something, you're trying to learn more. Study about computers. What's the goal? Is to learn more about the computer, right? Then you can use it more efficiently by learning more. But to study about God, you need to undo the knowledge you have. You're trying to learn less. You're trying to get rid of the concepts you have. This is nam mariom, is the expression. We do not know. So we need the sense that we don't know, that the intellect can't comprehend what it is we're experiencing or want to experience. It can just get us there. In the Shum language, we have a set of driving instructions for awareness. You know, first you turn left, then you turn right, then you go here, then you go there. Then you end up here. But there's no description of the here, right? Im Kaif, there's no description. Rade was very careful not to give a description. He just gives driving instructions. He doesn't tell you what you'll experience at the destination. So that's the idea of not acquiring a lot of knowledge about these deeper things. The knowledge is easily a barrier. Well, that's what we're talking about. There's a nice phrase here. Panentheism, monistic theism, is the view that embraces the oneness of God and soul, monism, and the reality of the personal God, theism. As panentheists, we believe in an eternal oneness of God and man, the level of Satchitananda and Parashiva. But a difference is acknowledged during the evolution of the soul body. Ultimately, even this difference merges in identity. Thus, there is perfectly beginningless oneness and a temporary difference which resolves itself in perfect identity. Nicely said. Have a great phase.